first of all, I would like to say how very happy I am to be here. It is really an honor to be part of this team that has been lined up for this conference of yours, and I hope that I can make some small contribution to that. I'd also like to take this opportunity at the beginning to bring you greetings from your fellow Lutherans in Canada. I expected and have found it to be the case that once I get here, I find that there are a number of you who have spent time in Canada, and others... others are expatriated Canadians. I was one of those for over 20 years. They used to talk about the brain drain from Canada that went down to the United States. I was part of it. I don't know how much brain you got, but... I was at least a missionary here for 20 years. And some Canadians I've already met are here. But I do find there are problems. I sat at breakfast, and one character sitting beside me, I'm never at my best until after breakfast. Not too good then, but I'm better. And he said, you know, Saskatoon, Saskatchewan always sounds to me like someplace in China. And that reminded me a story that was in Reader's Digest a few years ago. A couple of American women were going across Canada on the transcontinental train, and they had gone through considerably bleak prairie for quite a while, and they stopped at a rather attractive-looking city, and they didn't know quite sure where they were. And so they get out from the train, and they saw one of the natives standing there leaning against the station. They said, where are we? And he said, Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. And one lady nudged the other and said, see, they don't speak English here. But speaking of speaking English, last night, Professor Brigman laid upon me a task far too heavy for my shoulders. He suggested that we had one speaker here who spoke Lutheran but not English, another who spoke English but not Lutheran, and that I was the only one who could speak both English and Lutheran. I find that impossible on both counts. For one thing, if I came and spoke English, nobody in the United States would understand me. Secondly, I am aware that I am standing here in front of some 340-odd, and some of you very odd, Lutherans drawn from three synods, and any Lutheran knows that there is no way of speaking what will be considered Lutheran to all of the listeners. Only a Presbyterian could make that mistake. So you'll have to bear with what you get. It may not be English, it may not be Lutheran, but it'll be something, I hope. Last night, Mr. Pilgrim referred to the fact that Mr. Brigman had been allowed to choose his lectures. I think this is rank discrimination. My topic was given to me. I was asked to speak on religious experience and Lutheran theology. That was unfortunate because I didn't have any lectures on that topic. I don't know how many golf games I lost this summer writing these lectures. No more than I could help. But I can understand why you are interested in this topic of religious experience today, because certainly here in North America we live in a time when religious experience is on the ascendancy. Theology is in the doldrums, and new books on theology tend to be rather rare, and their sales are low. But there's a flood of books dealing with various forms of religious experience. One of our professors at Saskatoon a couple of years ago went through the catalogs of current books, and he found 65 books, new books, dealing with the topic primarily of speaking in tongues and the charismatic aspects of religious experience, but some 65 new books dealing with the area of religious experience. And these books sell at a fast pace. Pastors face problems with parishioners who claim that their religious experience has led them to see the superficiality of the doctrine and the practice of the churches to which they belong and to which you pastor. In the seminaries, we see these trends quite vividly. Back in the 1960s, the seminaries had a lot of students coming who were dedicated to social action and who were very strongly critical of the church. And many a churchman felt very uncomfortable. Seminaries that had publications, such as we did at Saskatoon, where the president was always getting nasty letters from people asking why the students had to say such horrible things about the church. Well, all of that's changed. The students today aren't saying anything nasty about the church. And there's a tendency out in the church for people to feel, isn't it good? At last we have seminary students who are not trying to tear the church apart. But I'd like to suggest that it may not be as good as it sounds. Because as I look back to the students we got in the 60s, yes, they were angry. They were very vocal in their criticism of the church, and yet underneath it lay a real love of the church. And there lay a real hope for the church. It was precisely because they believed the church could do great things and was not doing those great things that they were critical. They hoped that their criticism could somehow be a spur that would get the church to action. But if I'm reading the present scene correctly, today's student doesn't particularly love the church, and he certainly has no great hope that the church is going to do any great thing. For today's student, the church is not where the real action is. The real action lies in the inner experience of people, and at the best, the church can offer an opportunity to meet other people who might have similar experiences. And so they do not expect that the church as such is going to do great things. After all, the church is an organization. It is dedicated to a host of activities. And these can very frequently lead away from the deepening of the inner light, which is where the real Christianity is going to burn. And so there is a revival I see today of the old theme of the ecclesiola, in ecclesia, the little pure church within the larger structure of the more or less unredeemed church about it. Now these students dedicated to the primacy of inner experience find much of the seminary's offerings to be irrelevant to them. Interested in talking to Professor Brigham to find out whether he finds his students this way or not, but for many of ours, the disciplined study of the Bible is both a threat and a bore. They want to let the Bible simply speak to their inner feelings, and they find their own truths in the Bible. As such, the Bible becomes God's direct voice to them. And they sit in Old Testament or New Testament classes with a certain hostile suspicion as professors wrestle with problems of authorship, the time and the place where the book was written, and so on, and attempt to get at the original meaning of the text. To today's student, the important thing is not what Amos or Paul or Jesus originally intended to say when the scripture was written. The only important thing is, what does the Bible say to my experience today? And theology is perhaps even more abhorrent to these students than is disciplined Bible study. Religious beliefs cannot be obtained from theological efforts. They can only come from direct experience, what I know in my heart. I had an interesting experience this summer. I would not try to pretend this is typical of our students, but it does express in kind of an extreme form something that I think is happening. I got a call 10:30 one night, and it came from a fellow that I had met quite briefly last spring when he and his wife came in because they were planning to be students at the seminary this fall. And at this time that he called me, there was a revival meeting going on in downtown Saskatoon, sponsored not by any of the major churches, but by some of the smaller fundamentalist groups in the city. And when he called, he was obviously under considerable emotional tension. And he said, "Do you have some time?" "Well, I've always got time, you know, so sure, sure." "Well, then could you mind coming down here now?" 10:30 at night, I paused. Do I have that much time? And he said, "My wife has just met Jesus Christ." And in her meeting, she realized that her baptism as a Lutheran as a baby was invalid. And I know now she's right. And I want you to come down and baptize both of us again. Well, it was obvious to me that under these particular emotional situations, it was not the time for me to go down and give them a lecture on the Lutheran doctrine of baptism. So I tried to play for some time, and I suggested, well, maybe you could come and see me tomorrow, and I'd be happy to talk this over with you. But immediately he became rather hostile, and he said, by tomorrow it may be too late. She may have lost this experience. We need to do something tonight. And here was a situation, you see, where Lutheran theology was not what these people were interested in. What could it say to them that their experience had not already told them? And their experience told them that their infant baptism was invalid, and therefore they needed rebaptism as rapidly as possible. Now, as I say, I would not say this is typical, and I'm happy to say the student is now at seminary, and both he and his wife have a somewhat different view of things. They were not rebaptized, at least as far as I know, they were not. They called up another professor, Roger Nosbach, and Pilgrim knows, and he also didn't go down to rebaptize them. So if they got rebaptized, it wasn't by a Lutheran. But I think while this is an extreme case, it represents something that is going on. An increasing number of our students feel that the real basis of religion is in their religious experiences. And while most of them have not been led to the view that their baptism is invalid, or to other aspects of theology that might make them heretical from a Lutheran point of view, nonetheless, the seed is kind of there, and if their experience did lead them to feel that some aspect of Lutheran theology was wrong, then it would be their experience rather than their theology that would have to take the ascendancy. Now, this then, it seems to me, is something of the situation in which we find ourselves. It is because we are in a period when emphasis upon religious experience is so strong in so many quarters that I think you gave me this topic. And what I'd like to do is to, first of all, spend some time looking at maybe reasons for this phenomenon. Why is it that in our time it has come up? And that I hope to do immediately this morning. Next, then, I would like to look a little more generally, you might say philosophically and theologically, at the whole concept of religious experience. This is a term that we need, as the philosophers would say, to take apart, because it's one of those terms that gets tossed around a little lightly, and I think we need to ask ourselves just what is religious experience. And then finally, and this will actually take half of my total time, some two lectures, I would like to look at the whole question of religious experience, not as my topic asked me to do from the point of view of Lutheran theology, because as I suggested before, who can speak for Lutheran theology? I'm going to be somewhat more modest. I'm going to look at it from the point of view of Martin Luther's theology. And one thing I'm convinced of is that if Martin appeared today, he would be considered heretical by a considerable number of our Lutherans. But at any rate, we're going to look at it from his point of view, because I think rather fascinating that Luther faced exactly the same kinds of things that we are facing today, and therefore what he had to say about them, I think, can be helpful to our time. When we ask why is it that in our day and age there is this sudden upsurge in religious experience, I think the first thing we have to point out is that what is going on in the churches is parallel to and is really part of a much wider phenomenon in our society today. The emphasis upon inner experience had its roots in the so-called counterculture among our young people of the recent past. And in particular, it represents a revolt against reason, science, and technology. Now, ever since the Enlightenment, I may be transgressing a little bit on Professor Tillich's lecture on progress. On the other hand, hopefully, What I say and what he says will dovetail at this point. But ever since the Enlightenment, progress has been defined in terms of the advance of reason and science as they overcame ignorance and superstition. And progress has been defined in terms of the advance of medicine to cure disease, the abundant production of material goods and services to enhance the standard of living, in terms of technology that floods us with ever more material blessings, and so on. But this faith in progress has run into hard times of late. Critics have arisen, such as Jacques Ellul, who have argued that the growth of technology has brought more curse than blessing. It has alienated people from their work, forced products upon us that we do not need or particularly want, and worse, it has meant the burning up of our non-renewable resources at a fantastic rate, while it has encouraged an exploding population growth. And as a result, we face the limits of growth upon what is sometimes called our spaceship Earth, a very meaningful analogy, I think. Famine stalks the Earth. Isn't it interesting? A year ago, we had a food conference, and everybody was worried about famine, and we haven't heard anything about famine for ages. There are just as many people hungry as there were last fall, but it's no longer fashionable to talk about it. The technological societies are torn by inflation and depression at the same time. The Vietnam War, the Pentagon Papers, and Watergate have conspired to undermine faith in the rational and technological governments of the industrialized world. And as a result of all this, there's been a revulsion against reason and science. The primitive, superstitious countries cannot destroy the world. The existence of the world is not threatened by primitive, unscientific peoples, it is only threatened by the highly scientific, technological peoples. The critics cry out in fear that if we give up reason and science, then we're going to go back to the Dark Ages. We'll be back with Adolf Hitler thinking with our blood. But Arozak answers that charge by pointing out that Hitler was only made possible by a highly technological, scientific culture. To kill 6 million Jews, you had to have a lot of technological know-how simply to dispose of the bodies. To win a nation as Hitler did, you had to have a lot of scientific means of communication and propaganda. Herbert Marcuse has charged that our rational, technological, scientific world has resulted in what he calls a one-dimensional person. That is, it has encouraged us to see reality in terms of one dimension, of those things that you can see, weigh, and measure. As someone has said, if you cannot feel it or taste it, if you cannot weigh it or measure it, if you cannot use it to make a profit or to kill someone, then it doesn't exist. And that kind of sums up our technological view of reality. This is what it means to be a one-dimensional man. Now, a great many people in our culture have found this one-dimensional world too stifling. They claim there is more to reality than meets the eye. And there are many ways of seeing reality, many other ways than that of the rational and the scientific. Take, for example, the drug culture. There were many aspects of the drug culture, and of course a lot of people simply went into the drugs for the thrill of it and other things. But there has always been in the drug culture a very serious element which has argued that drugs were a means of expanding the mind, in order that reality might be seen that could not otherwise be seen. And when some of us tried to argue with young people caught up in this by saying, but how can you say when you dull your mind or distort your mind with a drug, how can you say then you are seeing reality? And the answer came back is to be born and raised in this technological scientific society of ours is to have your mind drugged, is to have your mind distorted, is to be forced to see things in a certain way. And given this kind of a situation, you need something to blow yourself out of it, to blast down these walls that have been put around us by all of our training and all of the presuppositions of our society. And so you need some kind of radical therapy, and you take the mind-expanding drug, and you see a reality. And hopefully the day may come when you no longer need the drug. You'll be now having had broken down all of the training, all of the manipulation that has gone on in making us see what we have seen in the past. When that is broken down, maybe we'll no longer need the crutch of the drug. And there was the turn to the drug culture. But also, of course, there was the turn to many other forms of experience. Eastern religion, Zen, and so on, became extremely popular as ways, non-scientific, non-rational ways of getting at reality that our scientific world had not been able to understand. Transcendental meditation has become a quasi-religious fad and extremely popular in many quarters. The writings of Carlos Castaneda and his perhaps mythical Don Juan have created a new interest in primitive religions, particularly those of our North American Indian, as a road to an experience of a reality that has been stifled in the Christian scientific technological society. Even witchcraft and magic made a comeback. That was one of the really unbelievable things. One of the great proofs of rational scientific progress had been that we destroyed magic and witchcraft. But suddenly these forms of experience have made a comeback in our culture. It was really interesting. I thought a couple of years ago in Saskatoon, at the university, the Lutheran student movement, some of the students suggested they ought to have an evening to study witchcraft. And the campus pastor thought he was being funny. He said, well, you know, if we're going to do that, we ought to get in a witch to speak to us. One of the students says, fine, I know three. And they got two of them in to speak, interestingly enough. Now, the counterculture's revolt against the scientific worldview turned in Christianity to the Jesus movement. There was a real link between the Jesus movement and the drug culture. A great many of the Jesus freaks had first been deep in the drug culture. They retained much of their drug culture language in what they had to say about Jesus. They took a trip on Jesus instead of LSD. To a great extent, they argued they'd gone into the drug culture for its mind-expanding qualities, its experiences of a reality beyond the rational, one-dimensional worldview. But they had found in Jesus an even greater mind expansion. But their Jesus was not so much the man who walked the roads of Palestine and died on a cross, but the Jesus who blew their minds here and now. In other words, it was Jesus as experience. But perhaps the interesting thing about the Jesus movement was that it did give Christianity a toehold in the new manifestation of religious experience. You know, in some ways, when we talk about the revolt against the rational scientific worldview, it sounds like it should be extremely helpful to Christianity and the Christian church. After all, have we not always believed that faith is the substance of things hoped for and things not seen? And therefore, should we not be very happy as Christians to see this revolt against the scientific rational worldview? But the problem was that we found we were identified with that worldview. And here it seems to me a real irony of the not-so-distant past. Back even in the 1950s, when I was on the campus of Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania, where I was a professor of religion and very much a missionary to the unbelievers in a highly rational, technological college, I found myself falling into an argument that was very popular in Christian circles those days, an argument drawn to some extent from A.N. Whitehead and others, to the general effect that science and Christianity, reason and Christianity, are not opposed to each other. On the contrary, the growth of science has been the result of Christian faith. I'm sure that, at least among the older of you here, we have all heard this argument many times. It was because Christianity, with its view of creation, which saw creation as being good and therefore something that could be used, but not sacred and therefore as something that could be used, therefore we gave rise to science. Well, I don't know when an apologetic has backfired more quickly than that one did. But when suddenly you find yourself in a situation where there is a rebellion against the scientific technological worldview, we suddenly found people pointing to the church and say, yeah, you're to blame for it. You've been telling us that it was Christianity that brought science into being. Well, look what a mess Christianity has made by bringing it into being. And so the Jesus movement was, I think, significant insofar as it did provide a toehold within Christian circles, within this general revolt against the scientific worldview. Now, it is not surprising, of course, that speaking in tongues has become part of this general revolt. How can you more dramatically revolt against all the reason and science and technology stands for than in the uninterpreted even babbling, says the outsider, that is involved in speaking in tongues? The outsider says it is babbling, but the insider says, yes, but it doesn't hurt anybody. It isn't destroying the environment. And as an actual matter of fact, it is a glimpse into reality over and beyond that of this everyday scientific technological society. And yet perhaps, as I say all of this, I'm really making the present turn to religious experience a bit more rational than it really is. Perhaps I'm making it a bit more of a revolt against a scientific technological worldview than it really is. Because in every age of insecurity and fear, there has been a turn to inner life to find the security that a fast-changing external world could not live. And today we live in a world of change, of insecurity, and of fear. There are many, many reasons for this, and I'll only mention a few. We live in an age of unparalleled rapidity of change. On all sides, we see the traditional ways and values going by the board. In Christian circles, because of our missionary movement, we've long been aware of the phrase cultural shock. This is what happens to a person who's been raised, born and bred in one particular culture, and then you take him out of that culture and put him in another culture, and it creates a total shock to his whole system to have to accommodate to a way of life, a way of seeing things that is totally alien to that from which he was brought up. And today, we find the interesting fact that you no longer have to go from one culture to another. You can stay in the same place and suffer cultural shock. And so some people today have coined a new term, future shock, to describe this. Recently, I saw where somebody made the interesting statement that anyone over 30 is an immigrant into the 1970s. And I think that's a very profound kind of insight. We may be living in the same place, but if we were born and raised more than 30 years ago, it means that we were born and raised in a culture that is extremely different from the culture in which we are now living in the 1970s. And we experience something of what all immigrants have experienced. We as Lutherans ought to be able to understand what's going on today because we have been to such a great extent an immigrant church in North America. But just for one example, of course, every immigrant has had the problem that he raises children who cannot speak his language. They are now living in a totally different culture from that in which the parents have been raised. And that is exactly the experience that parents are having with their children these days. They find the same problem of speaking to, of understanding their children that the immigrants have had in other times and in other places. And so we heard, at least a few years ago, we used to hear a great deal about the generation gap. Which is part of this being immigrants into the 1970s. Now, many of these changes that are going on may be good. They may be pleasurable. But one of the interesting things that modern science has discovered is that there is a limit to how much change any person can take. In fact, you can work out kind of a calculus of change, and when anybody gets too high a score, he's in trouble, physically, emotionally, spiritually. And that change may be undesirable, but it also may be highly desirable. Getting a promotion in your job is a change. You may be very happy to have gotten it, but it can also, it adds to your calculus of change and can be part of the problem. Now, in the midst of the insecurities generated by change, it is not surprising that many people turn to the inner life and its experience to find strength and escape and refuge. I have one experience of my own comes back here quite vividly. I still recall the day that I arrived in New York City to do graduate studies. Here I was. I had been born and raised on a farm in Saskatchewan in Canada. Then I'd gone to what we in those days called the large city of Saskatoon to go to university. In that time, Saskatoon had a population of about 30,000. And then all of a sudden, I'm transported out of this I land in Pennsylvania Station in New York. I walk outside and I see that concrete canyon of skyscrapers all around me. I ride subways. I meet the people at Union, and they are some cuts of different background where some of us got together. One fellow said, I come from a small town in Texas. And I thought that was good. He came from a small town. I'd understand him. I said, how large was the town? He said, oh, about 180,000. So here was a day that was filled. The change, I suppose, with the exception of the shock of finding out what inflation had done to prices after World War II, all of the change was highly delightful, highly stimulating to me, thrilling and so on. And yet, by the end of the day, I was really totally ragged in terms of the exposure to all of this in such a brief period of time. And so here was a day that was filled. The change, I suppose, with the exception of the shock of finding out what inflation had done to prices after World War II, all of the change was highly delightful, highly stimulating to me, thrilling and so on. And yet, by the end of the day, I was really totally ragged in terms of the exposure to all of this in such a brief period of time. And I still recall quite vividly, before I went to bed as usual that night, I prayed, and suddenly I had the sense that for the first time all day I was at home. Here was something that I was familiar with in this totally alien environment in which I found myself. Here was something that I knew, something that went back to my roots. And I had a deep sense at that time of the lines of the hymn, change and decay, and all around I see. O thou who changest not, abide with me. So I'm not surprised that in a time of such rapid change, a time when everything seems to be coming apart for many people in our society, many are turning to the inner life, turning to the experience of God, to that which does not change, and finding there something of a rock that they can cling to. And the worse things seem to be outside, the more inclined we are to turn into the inner life and to find there the kind of security that cannot be given to us by the world outside. As I say, even pleasant change can bring problems, but of course, we live in an age when many unpleasant changes are occurring. As I said before, we've come face to face with the limits of growth in our spaceship Earth. This is most evident for the moment in the fact that the era of cheap energy is over. We built a great deal of our civilization upon the energy supplied by hydrocarbon fossil fuels, but these are being rapidly depleted. The Third World has suddenly refused to go on subsidizing the standard of living of North America and Europe, and so the price of these diminishing fuels has shot up. For the moment, in both the United States and Canada, we are being artificially protected from the full blow of this event. Despite the cries of anguish that we make when we pull up to the gasoline station, we are still paying for gasoline only a fraction of what other countries are paying. But fuel is only one of many ways in which the limits of growth are squeezing us. The basic cause of our inflation is that as the overall standard of living is being forced down, every group in society that has any power is fighting to see that it is someone else's standard of living that goes down most. But this simply, and so profits, wages, salaries, and prices go up,
But this simply results in more money chasing fewer goods, and thus inflation continues apace. Very slowly it is creeping into the conscience of our people that this human race cannot be supported in the manner to which North Americans have become accustomed. Dr. Marshall, president of LCA, was in Saskatoon speaking this summer. He made the comment, I wouldn't be surprised if some of the rest of you have heard it, because it seemed something was very much on his heart, and I'm sure he said it other places. He said for many years he was able to still his conscience over the fact of his much higher standard of living than that of the millions of people in the world. He was able to still his conscience with the idea that someday we would share this standard of living with the whole world. But now he has to face the fact that the whole world cannot be brought up to our standard of living. There are just not enough resources. Pollution that it would cause and so on makes it a total impossibility. And therefore, if there is going to be greater equality in the world, it can only mean that our standard of living must go down, not that we can raise other people's to ours. And our standard of living is going to go down. And that's a great blow to the people of our culture, because we've always lived on this dream that things are going to be better for our children than they have been for us. We build our philosophy around growth, and growth means greater prosperity for all. And now suddenly we're being forced, and it's only very, very dimly beginning to move into our consciences, being forced to realize that, as an actual matter of fact, our children are not going to have more than we've got. As an actual matter of fact, never again will anyone have it as good as we in North America have had it and still have it for a few fleeting years yet. Now, this understanding is a particularly difficult one for us because, as Jacques Ellul has pointed out, the whole development of the technological society has been based upon two primary assumptions. The first of these assumptions or presuppositions is that the chief end of human beings is happiness. And the second assumption has been that the means of achieving happiness is to have more and more of the material gadgets, comforts that technology can supply us. These have been two unquestioned premises of our society. And when we have spoken of progress, we have always meant the achievement of more and more technological triumphs, providing more and more physical comforts and conveniences for life, because they were the means whereby greater happiness would be achieved. But today we live in a world where there is not only a limit to such progress, but even the grim reality that, given these definitions, we seek regress, not progress. And so people are frightened. They are frustrated at the prospect. They wonder how life can even be meaningful if, when everything we said makes life meaningful, faces this bleak prospect. The change that is coming upon us, therefore, is not a desirable change to most people. And in such a situation, there are many expressions of the frustration and the fear of our people. And it is not surprising that many facing this frustration, facing this fear, are turning to the inner life of religious experience and trying to find there a meaning, a happiness, a joy that the outside world cannot promise or give us at this time. All right. This seems to me to be some of the reasons why, in our culture today, you have this phenomenon of emphasis upon religious experience growing. And I do not pretend that I have given a full sociological, psychological analysis of it. Each of you, I think, could add a great many other things. Hopefully, I've got your mind moving to try and analyze some of the things that are feeding this emphasis upon religious experience today. I would like now to turn to the second aspect of my lectures, and that is the question of what do we mean when we talk about religious experience. I don't know if somebody's trying to tell me something or not, but the clock at the back of the room is 15 minutes fast. I'm going to ignore it. When we raise the question of the place of religious experience, And what is its relationship to religious knowledge? We could say very quickly and easily that as an actual matter of fact, there is never any knowledge apart from experience. And therefore, if there is to be religious knowledge, there must be some experience of religious phenomenon. And this is an important point. It is true, and yet it is a half-truth that can be dangerous. And so I'd like to look more closely at it. Now, I suppose most of you have had some exposure to philosophy and are aware of the fact that in philosophical circles there is an ongoing debate about the source and the origin of knowledge. One group of philosophers have argued that all human knowledge comes from experience. Without experience, they have told us, the mind is a tabula rasa, a blank board, an empty cupboard waiting to be written upon by experience or to have something put into it by experience. Other philosophers have argued that there is what they would call a priori or innate knowledge which human beings have apart from any experience, prior to experience and apart from experience. Philosophers who have argued that human beings do have knowledge that is innate or a priori, that is not gained through experience, have not always been agreed as to the content of this knowledge. Those of you who recall your study of Plato, oh, come on, you all remember Plato. You'll remember how Socrates brought in an untrained slave boy, and by asking certain artful questions, proved to his satisfaction that the slave boy had an innate, inborn knowledge of certain mathematical theorems. Unfortunately, some of us who struggled through mathematics did not find confirming evidence in our own careers. Other philosophers have argued that humans are born with innate moral conviction. People are born knowing what is right and what is wrong. But here again, as you look at the great variety of ethical and moral systems that have existed around the world, it is difficult to really believe that there is some innate knowledge of what is right and what is wrong. And anyone who has brought up a child knows that you cannot simply let them do what comes naturally and they will thereby learn what is right and what is wrong. It's not my intention this morning to get involved in the age-old philosophical debate as to whether or not all knowledge comes through experience or whether some is inborn and innate. But suffice it to say that any philosopher today who would argue for innate knowledge has a pretty rough row to hoe. The evidence is against it. In fact, one of the unique things about human beings as compared to other forms of life is that the human being does not seem to be programmed as other forms of life. The ant or the bee seems to have built into their gene system a whole social behavior, and so an ant hill or a beehive has the very same, very complex social structure century after century. But human beings have to learn anew the wisdom of the ages, and the result is human beings have spawned an incredible number of social ways of living, and so on. The human child has to be taught. And so it is sometimes said we are never more than one generation from barbarism. And that's a good point. If the child is not taught in the ways of civilization, whether that's good or bad, I won't argue, the child will not be a civilized child. Those who would argue then that humans have any knowledge other than that gained through experience certainly have a rough hole to hoe then, as I say. But the question is, what do we mean when we say experience? Well, obviously, we mean what comes to us through our five senses. We learn through our experience of seeing, of feeling, tasting, hearing, smelling. No one can deny that a vast amount of what we know comes to us through one or more of our five senses. When someone like a Helen Keller is deprived of one or more of the five senses, the other senses seem to be developed even more in order that learning is able to take place. A blind person thus develops a far more keen sense of touch, smell, and hearing than the normal person does. Quite obviously, then, a vast amount of our learning comes through our five senses. And here, of course, we have another philosophical battle, because there are those philosophers and psychologists who would say that all knowledge and all experience come through our five senses. And anything that does not so come cannot be considered real, cannot be considered knowledge. Now here I must confess I have to enter into this philosophical debate, because it seems obvious to me that all of us have experiences that are not primarily a matter of our five senses. We experience love, hate, sadness, joy, frustration, satisfaction, worry, peace, and a host of other experiences. And I would argue that would not argue that such experiences are divorced from our five senses. Usually if we feel sad, it is because we've seen, read, or heard something that caused us to feel sad and so on. But what I'm saying is that the feeling of joy or of sadness is just as real an experience as the seeing or the feeling that may also accompany it. And so I would argue that our experience is richer than just what is involved in the five senses. But of course, there's another debate going on today about the five senses. Is there such a thing as extrasensory perception? Many intelligent people are convinced there is. A vast number of experiments have been conducted in recent years, we think particularly of the Duke experiments, to test whether or not at least some people have extrasensory perception. And some amazing things have happened. People have been found who can read cards or get messages without using any of the five senses. From a scientific point of view, the experiments are frustrating, of course, because you'll get somebody and you set him in one room and somebody else in another room is reading cards, and this guy who can't see the cards will come up with the correct answer. He'll beat chance all to bits, just fantastic results for a period of time, and then all of a sudden he seems to lose it. And that doesn't fit the normal scientific understanding of things, so scientists have a great deal of difficulty with all of this. But just because it doesn't fit the contemporary scientific presuppositions does not mean that there may not be a reality involved here. Now, the whole question of extrasensory perception, mental telepathy, and the rest is a vast field, and it's highly controversial. And it might seem, therefore, to be best for us in a theological lecture of this kind to ignore it. But I don't really think we can do so. Down through the centuries, religious mystics have claimed they possess a sixth sense, an eye of faith, with which they can see or experience God. Now, the mystic might not like to be classified with a mind reader, but they have this in common. Both claim to gain knowledge through an experience that is independent of any of the five normal senses. If mental telepathy were to be proven beyond doubt, it would certainly force us to consider the possibility that the mystic may be able to communicate directly with the mind of God. After all, if that guy can communicate directly with the mind of someone else in the other room reading cards, why should I not be able to communicate directly with the mind of God? I don't answer the question of extrasensory experience, therefore, but I say we cannot ignore it either. When we look at the question, then, of experience and knowledge and recognize that experience includes not only the data provided by our five senses, but also our inner feelings, and perhaps also extrasensory perception, it becomes evident that little, if any, knowledge we have comes to us without experience. And so it would seem quite obvious that if we are to have knowledge, we must, in religion, we must have religious experience. So what is all the fuss about? Those who emphasize religious experience today and who say it is more important than theology or other aspects of religious life, are they not simply pointing to the obvious? Without experience, we would have no knowledge. And if there's to be religious knowledge, there has to be religious experience. And what more is there to say? And if all knowledge is based on experience, then certainly a person's knowledge that his or her baptism as an infant has been invalid, this should be more of a final understanding than anything we might be able to come up with in Lutheran theology. But the problem is not that simple. All knowledge may presuppose experience, but what is the experience? What is the relationship between experience and knowledge? This is obviously complex. I have the experience of seeing an object, and I say, this is a bridge. My knowledge that it is a bridge, however, does not simply come from my experience of seeing it. If I have with me a child who is learning to speak English, the child has the same experience of seeing the object that I do, but the child does not see a bridge. To know that this object is a bridge, I have to know, first of all, the meaning of words in the English language. And secondly, I have to have had earlier experiences of seeing bridges. Perhaps this bridge does not look like other bridges I have seen. Yesterday, after a long wait for the boat, we finally got on a school bus, and a series of traumatic experiences followed that. And one of the first of which was we crossed something. I guess it was a bridge. It didn't really look like bridges in my experience. And it just had these two very narrow things, and I hope that driver was sober because he had to thread a pretty fine needle getting across this thing. But it did span two banks of a creek, and I assume, therefore, it was a bridge. Now, I use this illustration simply to point out that experience and knowledge have to be connected by some act of reasoning. And it is never quite the case that we to see is to know. It is never that simple. The experience always has to be interpreted. And I think this is very relevant as we come to our topic for this week of religious experience. When someone says, for example, they have experienced God, then we need to be rightfully skeptical. One of the things I'm going to be referring to later in my lecture is Luther's skepticism, when he was surrounded with people who had direct voices from God and direct experiences from God. And Luther had an extremely healthy skepticism of anybody who'd been talking to God, or worse still, to whom God had been talking. And if somebody comes up and says, I have experienced God, don't be too hasty to say, great, wonderful, what did he say? First of all, let's find out, what does this person mean by the word God? Are they using the word God in the way in which we would use the word God? Where did they learn the meaning of the word God? In the world in which we live, there are many meanings of the word God, many meaning of gods. Is this person who claims to have experienced God referring to the Christian God or to some other God? And how do we decide which God they are referring to? The experience alone cannot tell us. It is a well-known fact from the writings of the mystics of the world over that their experience of God seems to be, so far as you can tell, psychologically speaking, very similar. Whether a mystic is a Christian in Europe, whether he is a Hindu in India, a Buddhist in China, so far as you can tell from reading the description of the psychological experience, it is very similar experience. But whether they identify the experience in terms of the Christian God, or whether they interpret it in terms of Brahma or Atman or some other God, depends apparently upon their past training and upon the culture from out of which they have come. In other words, the experience does not seem to be definitive in and of itself. It has to be interpreted. And that, of course, raises the question of who interprets the experience correctly. But this means, of course, that we really cannot get away from theology to religious experience, pure and simple. It sounds so good as to say, well, you never solved anything in theology anyhow, so let's just go out and let God speak to us. Let's let the experience be our guide. But the problem is that we cannot simply let experience be our guide. We have to interpret the experience. And the minute we interpret the experience, we are involved in theology. Our theology may be good theology or it may be bad theology. It may be well thought out in the light of reliable criteria, or it may be purely subjective. But it is theology. Every time somebody says, this is my religious experience, he's giving you his theology. Now, we've not yet looked at the question of Lutheran theology, but upon a purely philosophical basis, we can say that there is obviously a danger in a flight from theology to religious experience. Without a theological interpretation, experience is meaningless. But if we claim that what we say is based upon experience and not upon theology, what we're really trying to do is to sneak our particular theology in without a proper examination of it. And the student that called me up would have said it is my experience, or in this case, my wife's experience, which tells her that her baptism as an infant was invalid. But as an actual matter of fact, of course, there was an awful lot of theology gone between whatever was her raw experience, if you can even talk of such a thing, and her conclusion that that infant baptism was invalid. Somehow, in the context of that meeting in which she had, quote, met Christ, there had been an interpretation, a theology, which she had accepted, and which colored the experience she claimed to have. And therefore, when someone tells us that their experience must be the ultimate criteria, what they are really saying is their theology must be. Now, if somebody comes up and tells me that his theology is the final criteria, I can argue with that. But when someone comes up and says, I have no theology, but I have a clear experience of God which says that, he still has theology. But it's extremely difficult to even argue with that theology. But at least we have to be forewarned to recognize that there is a great deal of theology there. Paul, you'll remember, called upon us to test the spirits. Paul was very much aware that in the world of his day, many people had spiritual, religious experiences. There was nothing unusual about it in the world of biblical times. Christians were in no sense the only people who had religious experience. In fact, religious experience was all over the place. Spirits were everywhere, and everybody claimed that they would be speaking by the inspiration of some spirit. And Paul, therefore, had to tell his people to test the spirit. Not every spirit is the Holy Spirit. Therefore, it is important that we test the spirit when it comes. But a test of a spirit is a theological task. To deny theology, therefore, is to refuse to test the spirit. And so if a neutral philosophical analysis can see the danger of turning to religious experience without theology, Paul's Christian teaching, I believe, underlines it and gives it even greater cogency. We have to test the spirits, and that means to test our religious experiences. And that, I think, justifies us in having as our topic Lutheran theology and religious experience. As Lutherans, I think we need to take a look and see how we evaluate religious experience and how we may be able to test the spirit. And with that, I think I bring this lecture to an end. Last night you weren't terribly alert in raising questions, and I understand that. It is a very large group. On the other hand, I always hate to fire a lecture at a group of people and run. So I am open to questions if anybody has them. I don't know, Mr. Pilgrim, do you want to take over here, or somebody over in that corner? Yes.
Are you going to, in your next lecture, get into this testing that you just mentioned?
I'm going to get into it in the next three lectures.
Thank you.
Today I was laying the basis for the need to make a test. And ultimately, you know, confessing exactly where I'm at, I think Luther had some excellent tests, and that's ultimately where I'm going to come out at. Yes?
You've got a number of things asked. One of the things I'd like to respond at is being over 30 in the 70s. You claim I'm an immigrant, alien, and I'm trying to tie this in with the lecture last night. I seem to hear the voice last night that said, we are too much at home. And we are comfortable where we're at. We need to get back on the boundary. I see a tension here, and I wonder if there's no place in this series of lectures for you to respond to one another as lecturers, and I hate to put that dimension into it here. But I'm just wondering if you feel some of that tension, and if you could...
Um, Well, as an accident, yes, I think the tension is a very important one. I appreciate your raising it. Professor Bergman ought to perhaps also get involved in it, but I would point out to you, you could have found the tension in my lecture. You don't have to compare it to Professor Bergman's last night, because I was also arguing that in our culture, we have all had our ways of thinking dominated, molded, programmed by the scientific, rational, technological worldview. And this, I think, is, kind of the tension. To be in the 1970s is, on the one hand, to be very much modeled, molded, and made by the culture in which we find ourselves. And yet also, to be in the 1970s and to be over 30 is to be in this tension of being somehow an alien in it. And I suppose part at least of the alien aspect of it is the fact that our young people are suddenly questioning this whole way of thinking upon which we've been brought up. But our young people themselves say, yeah, we've been conditioned with it too. And that's why we need something radical like a trip in LSD or marijuana or something to break us out of what we've been conditioned with. So I think that in a time of change like ours, there is this tension. It's a paradox, if you like. On the one hand, we are conditioned by our culture, by our upbringing. On the other hand, in a world of rapid change, we also find that we are not at home in it. And in terms of what Professor Bergman was saying last night, of course, what I'm saying is that it is not necessarily good. He was saying that we need options, we need choices. And I think that what many people feel caught in this tension in the 70s is we don't have options. We are not choosing our worldview. We are being buffeted. And that is what I think is the real problem of that causes many to escape into religious experience, to get out of this tension. On the one hand, molded by the society, on the other hand, feeling alien to it, caught in this, not quite knowing who or what I am, where I'm going, get out of it.
I don't feel that I know what you mean by religious experience. And I wonder if you could try to offer a concise definition of that.
I'm very happy that you don't know what I mean by religious experience, because one of my basic theses is that most people who talk about religious experience don't know what they mean by it. And therefore, that's the other part of my lecture tomorrow. I'll come to that.